Good afternoon. Thank you all for staying for the last presentation this session. I hope you'll find this fun and informative. My name is David Wong. I'm a medical epidemiologist with the National Park Service Office of Public Health. And my primary job duties are to respond to outbreaks and case reports that are associated with national parks, and also to develop surveillance systems for human disease. And time permitting, I also work on public health research projects and to develop park-based public health programming. And so today I'm going to talk to you about a pilot project that we started in 2007 to encourage park rangers to develop public health-focused programs for visitors. I have no financial relationships to disclose. Many of you know that Yellowstone National Park was the first national park actually in the world, and it was started in 1872. And it wasn't until 1916 that the National Park Service was created as the federal agency to manage these protected federal lands. And in 1916, at that time, there were about 40 different national parks and national monuments, mostly in the western United States. And today we have now 391 park units in 49 states and 4 territories. The only state that does not have Park Service presence is Delaware. And even though we primarily think of, when we think of the Park Service, we think about Yellowstone and Grand Canyon, Yosemite, and those granddaddy parks. National parks only make up, there are only 58 national parks, and they make up about 15% of all the units. So there are many, many more out there that many of us enjoy. When you look at all the parks together, the total acreage is about the size of Montana, just a little bit under it. And we like to think of the visitation as just under the population of the United States. In 2007, it was estimated at 276 million persons. Now, if you look at this quote in the upper right, you'll see that education as well as land preservation has been a primary focus of the Park Service, even in its early days. And in the Park Service, we don't really use the word education, we use the word interpretation. And it's defined as the process of providing each visitor an opportunity to personally connect with the place. And the rangers that are involved with interpretation are called interpretive rangers, in contrast to the other type of ranger, the law enforcement ranger, which is very self-explanatory what they do. And when every year we do surveys with about 30 parks, random samples of visitors to see what they liked about the parks and what they didn't. And every year, one of the highest scoring elements is the interpretive programs. It's rated 89%, 2006 rated them as good or very good. And if you look at the funding and contacts that we have, of these 275 million estimated visitors, about 75 million of them have some contact with the interpretive program, either a ranger directly or with just visitor centers. So a lot of people have potential contact for education. And a large chunk of the budget, as well as the employees, are dedicated to interpretation. Now, many of you have been to parks and have probably attended some sessions, and the programs are very varied. You could have a ranger-led talk, hike, could be a campfire program, museums, exhibits, etc. There are a lot of different ways that they get their messages across. But traditionally, when you go to a park, you're going to hear mostly about natural resources like the wildlife and geology, etc., and also cultural resources. Depending on the park, you may hear about the history of the building or what made that park significant. So we felt that this was a great opportunity for park rangers to interface with all these different visitors in these fun and exciting settings, to have them to develop public health-focused programs. And so in 2007, our office had an increase in our base budget funding, and we got it very late in the year, and so we had to quickly turn it around. And so we gave parks about 30 days to come up with proposals, and we gave our request for proposals to all 391 parks, and we said that we'd give them up to $10,000, and our guidelines were very simple. At least one-third of the content had to focus directly on local public health issue, concern, or issue. And we encourage them to link their programs with other subject areas like history, culture, ecology, because we wanted to make it interesting. We didn't want it to be 100% public health. It may be hard for people to attend those when they're out in the park having fun. And we also had an evaluation component so we could see how well this worked. We reviewed the proposals with 6 different folks at the Park Service. They were all from different disciplines. And our criteria were looking at public health significance, the appropriateness of the interpretive theme, the creativity, whether or not the program was sustainable after the seed money expired, and the overall clarity of the proposal. We were actually very surprised that even though we only gave people about 30 days, and it was right before the park season was about to start, we actually got 32 proposals, so we were very happy about that. We ended up awarding 16 of them, and most parks requested the full $10,000, some requested less. The mean award was about $9,000. And we got a lot of applicants from a wide range of different types of parks, and we were pleased that we were able to award them to very different types of units. We had good geographic representation. And many of these parks, and whether or not you guys know this or not, they do, in order to establish their programs, rely a lot on collaboration. Base budget funding from the Park Service is not really enough for them to do all the things that they do. And so in developing these programs, 75% of them did collaboration with at least one other outside organization. Most of them were universities, some of them were healthcare facilities, NGOs, etc. Of note, only two of them collaborated with their local or state health departments, and none of them collaborated with CDC. Now, of the public health topics that were chosen and selected, a wide breadth of topics as well. Many infectious diseases like plague, tick-borne diseases, mosquito-borne diseases, environmental health issues like heat-related illness, air pollution. We had some injury prevention projects, and also chronic disease and wellness. And these don't add up to 16 because some programs had more than two topics per their proposal. So I just wanted to go through a few of these programs so you can get a sense about what they came up with. This first project came out of Lowell National Historical Park in Massachusetts. And this National Historical Park was established to commemorate America's Industrial Revolution. And in the history of the Industrial Revolution, there actually had been a very large typhoid epidemic on the Merrimack River that runs through this park. And it was called River of Death. And that title actually comes from a newspaper article that was published in the local paper. And this typhoid epidemic was in the 1890s. There were 452 reported cases. About 25% of them died. And this epidemic was investigated by Dr. Sedgwick, who was a MIT professor and epidemiologist and considered an early public health pioneer. And that's him there in the corner. And what Lowell developed was an interactive program where they have a flip chart with 17 different panels, and it was designed by a collaborative they have with the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and that particular group there is called the Tsongas Industrial History Center. And they piloted these versions, first of all, in the middle school, grades 6 to 9, and then the second version is actually a guided ranger talk, which is going to be done actually on the very river that was infected, so people can be right there as they learn about, you know, what happened in the 1890s. And this is a really good project that incorporated public health and history. It was very well received by the students, and the visitor version was not tested until May 2008, and I have heard it's gone well, but I don't know any details about it. Another program, this is a very different one out of South Dakota at Badlands National Park. And for those of you who know that part of South Dakota, it's adjacent to many Native American tribes. And so they wanted to develop a diabetes and obesity prevention project for fourth graders on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And what they did was they took these classes out to the Badlands to do a ranger-guided tour of the park. And then they had a big map of the park in the classroom. And so they had these imaginary walks where students, for any 30 minutes of activity they did, they would move their pushpin 1 mile on the map. And they had to do this as a team. So there's teams of about three or four folks. In order to move the pushpin, everyone had to do 30 minutes of exercise to get that 1 mile. So they had to encourage everyone to participate. And as they reached certain milestones, like visitor centers or overlook sites, they would receive prizes like hats and pencils. And a ranger would come in two or three times in the school year to give talks about healthy food and habits. And they also worked with the tribal representative to discuss the spiritual connection of the Badlands and how important that is to the Lakota Sioux. So they really unfolded many different types of things to really encourage these fourth graders to get out and walk, etc. And so in fall 2007, they had 65 students that completed this program, and they each had to walk 74 miles. Just a few other ones I'm going to go through really quickly. There's a picture on the left, Mississippi National River Recreation Area. They develop podcasts for people who are walking on the Mississippi River. Booker T. Washington, they had many different projects with their proposal, but this one was called Blockades and Stockades, Civil War Shortages and Substitutions. So in the Civil War, there may be shortages of salt or butter, depending on what was going on. And they drew a parallel to today of how you could substitute bad foods with healthy foods, just maybe as they would have done in the Civil War period. And then the bottom one is from Hawaii Volcanoes, Life and Breath of Kilauea. This was a ranger-guided talk to learn about the health effects of VOG, volcanic gas emissions. And then for folks that are involved, they also looked at, for little kids, they did the vinegar baking soda, you know, volcano thing coming out. So it's been very well attended. And actually, this year, Kilauea erupted. And so this program is now given every day, and it's one of their most popular programs that they offer. As far as the evaluation, I'll just run through this pretty quickly. We asked anyone who was involved with the program, either Park Service or a partner, to fill out an online survey, and we had a 70% response rate. And I'll just go through it, first of all, just what we learned about the programs themselves. There were a total of 11,800 visitor contacts for our programs, a range of 53 to 4,000. Most of the programs had about 100 to 500 contacts. And I'll highlight here that 93% of the folks felt that the projects were supported by park management. And that's very important. If you want to have a program succeed in the parks, the supervisor and the staff really need to be behind it. The other thing I want to point out is that only 3% said that these programs would have been implemented without our funds. These are not projects that were going to happen with unless we gave them the seed money. Now, asking about the actual people who did the education, they felt that they were very knowledgeable about the health topic. They agreed that the parks were good, excellent settings for delivering public health messages. Folks were very enthusiastic. People did say that they would consider partnering with CDC and health departments, just not historically what parks have done. They've done a lot more partnership with academia. And unfortunately, because of OMB restrictions, we weren't able to pull more than 9 visitors without going through a very rigorous paperwork process. So we just asked the folks what they felt the visitors liked about it. Most people thought that they did enjoy the programs. Most people thought that they would be interested in having more public health-focused programs offered. Certainly, this is not the best way to evaluate, but it's the best that we could do in a short amount of time. Some of the programs got some media coverage. This was a project in Denali National Park in Alaska where they had a high school student that would rove and educate people about safety when they were doing day hikes. And they actually he ran into a reporter from Fairbanks who really liked the idea and reported about it. So in conclusion, I just want to say park rangers are non-traditional and probably underutilized resource for public health education. I think from some of the programs that you've seen, some of the strengths that park rangers and parks offer are very creative folks. The interpretive rangers come up with wonderful ideas. Unfortunately, I couldn't share all the programs with you. Very varied program formats. And the parks are very fun and unique environments for learning. These are all things that encourage people's ability to learn about these topics. We covered a broad range of public health topics that were all germane to the parks. Certainly, we wouldn't want them talking about something that had no relation to what was going on, but there's so many issues when you think about people going outside, vector-borne disease, water safety, injury, etc. And also important to highlight that there was potentially a very large impact in outreach from a very small investment. At most, we only it cost $10,000 or less for each of these programs. And I also want to highlight that this is an opportunity for folks to work with either state, local health departments or the CDC, and we're trying to do that in the future. And just as far as our next steps, unfortunately, we didn't have funds to continue this program again in FY08, but for FY09, we're looking for other funding and partnerships. We've already contacted the National Park Foundation. I used to work at CDC as an ES officer, and we're working with some disease-specific centers to see if they want to offer, you know, funds for just water safety programs or water-borne diseases, et cetera. We're trying to find if we can find partners for that. Also state health departments, CSTE, APHA, et cetera. Also, I think some of the programs that have been very successful, like the Badlands, I think there's the potential and the possibility that we could partner specifically for a specific program with organizations that might be appropriate. So with the Walking the Badlands program, they weren't able to do that this year again. But, you know, I've talked with Indian Health Service, Department of Education, I haven't yet, but there are other groups that we could focus if they were interested in taking these ideas that are started and then turning them into something more. That's it. these are all the other parks that we worked with.
I'm going to ask this, all the speakers to come up here so that you'll be able to use the microphone for questions. I will repeat the questions so that it gets recorded. And I really want, if the speakers would come up, please. And I really want to thank the speakers for staying on time. I think this is a record. This is his first time in which I did not cut someone off for going over time. And I really appreciate because it particularly is courteous to, if you guys can come up, you don't have to stand. It's courteous to the other speakers. So questions? Yes. I think if I understood correctly, the question was that the limitation that was stated was that students did not participate in the survey, but since it was directed at trying to target faculty in schools of public health, basically sort of why was that a limitation? So.
That's a very good question. Our target was only a public health faculty, and we asked them of their perceptions regarding student learning. And so that was the limitation. I think that if we were to survey students' perceptions, you know, they might be very different or they might be similar to faculties. So I think there's a research recommendation there where it would be very interesting to find out what students' perceptions are regarding their own learning and make comparisons with what the faculty think, you know, their students' perceptions are.
Okay. Other questions? Karen. Okay, the question, if you want to come up to the mic. The question was, given the very limited resources and hard economic times that we're in, what is the justification for giving money for prison health care rather than for other types of health care or other types of programs?
And is it required?
Required?
justification
for providing prison health care. I
must say I'm slightly surprised if I understand the question, because I thought as public health people, we were wanted to provide services by need, and that we were provided services by greatest need. And the justification for our project in Europe was simply because if we were looking at any community at any one time, the greatest number of people, I'm talking about my own country, the greatest number of people with HIV positive, for example, the greatest number with particular addictions would be found in the local prison. If we shut these people up forever, then of course that is one thing. But these people are going in and out of prisons. They are, as someone said at another session, at a member of our project, the fact that they're in prison doesn't remove from them the fact that they're a member of the community. You know, imprisonment is the loss of freedom. It shouldn't mean the loss of anything else. Now, I do understand, because we had a very strong point made. We were talking about mental health in prisons, and one member of the audience pointed out that in some ways the case in America was quite different, because he said, if I understood him correctly, the only people guaranteed mental health care were those in prison. Now, of course, throughout Europe, it's a very different position. And this is why comparing our situations is so valuable. You know, same problems, different ideas, different cultures, different approaches, end result, better all round.
Other questions? Yes. The question is how did the idea of park rangers as health educators come about?
You know, really it was just an idea that we had because we know that the interpretive rangers were there giving talks to the visitors. We just thought it would be a great opportunity. We asked the chief of the Division of Interpretation at the Park Service how many parks that he knew of that were doing public health programming for visitors, and he couldn't think of any. And that's not to say that he knows about all the programs that are going on, because certainly they don't all filter up to Washington. But we felt that because that wasn't going on, if we could provide an incentive, at least to plant the idea in park rangers' heads that this is something that they could and potentially should do, and if it went well, then we could try and expand the program. So it's really just a simple idea to start with. I mean, I do have a health background, but I mean, I'm not. There may be other people, you know, that were involved too, you know. But I think that my background in CDC certainly was influential. If I just came in as into the Park Service, I was a pediatrician. If I certainly came straight from residency into Park Service, I'm not sure I would have had that focus. And my training at CDC was in STD, where education is so critical. I mean, we do so much education in STD to try and prevent these diseases, and sometimes it's very challenging. But I think in the Park Service, I think what we're one of our advantages, as I said in the conclusions, is that these environments, people are very ready and willing to learn about things. When I go to a park, I want to seek out that ranger and learn about whatever that park has to offer. So if they can also provide a little bit of public health education folded into that, you know, people get a lot out of that. And that was the experience that we had.
Other questions? Yes. The question is, depending upon the administration change, would you expect more or less funding for this initiative?
It's a very good question. And just to give you a little bit more history, the Office of Public Health, we are a very small program within the Park Service. We get very small amount of money. And my boss, Chuck Higgins, You know, when he decided that he wanted to have an epidemiologist of the Park Service, it took him about 3 years to convince people that we needed an epidemiologist versus more rangers, which there are lots of parks that have shortages of rangers. And so he's done a really good job, I think, selling the importance of public health. We didn't talk about a lot of our surveillance and disease response activities, but that's been a very appreciated aspect that we've added to the Park Service since I've been there for about 2.5 years. We have, as I showed on the slide, that the park's been around since 1916, Park Service. So we have our 100th year anniversary coming up in 2016. And so we're hoping, because of the 100th year anniversary, we're going to be getting increased funds from the government to spruce up our parks and get ready for this celebration. And we're hoping that the Office of Public Health will be able to kind of ride in on those coattails and get some of that money, and we can do additional programming, work with other great partners, because a lot of these projects we cannot do by ourselves. Our office is 13 people, and most of them are people that do food inspections and water and wastewater inspections out in the field. And so the number of people devoted to this kind of issue is very small, so we really need to depend on partners. And so this was a wonderful project for us because it was very inexpensive, and most of the work was conducted by people out in the field.
Other questions, comments? I'll give the opportunity then to the panel. Is there anybody who didn't get to say something that they would like to add to? That's amazing. That's well planned. Yes, in the back. The comment was thanking David for his mention of Native Americans. Yes. Yes. And I would re-echo that comment that that's what I found so exciting about this, was because these are places or ways in which we have not traditionally thought of health education, but when you hear it, it's like, sort of like the V8, you know, kind of thing. Oh, you know, why didn't I think of that before? Of course we should be doing that. So, yes, thank you very, very much. And we basically are out of time. If anybody would like to talk to any of our presenters individually, I'm sure they would be happy to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is this going to somebody?
Yes, I was here.
Nice.
Cool.
Thank you very much.
Nice
enthusiastic.
Nice meeting you ever so briefly.
I just
like
everything
you
said. But it's interesting.
Deaf students in deaf high schools for HIV knowledge and
behaviors.
No.
Who is Lena?
No.
She actually did wrong with HIV.
Okay, it sounds familiar, but we're just getting into that in New York City now because our survey was actually 14 schools throughout the U.S. So we've scheduled more than 500, surveyed more than 500 kids. And we, of course, learned that there's high risk and low knowledge, so we're hoping to do an HIV curriculum and use kind of the same format that we have here because it was so well received. This was NIDA, National Institute on Drug Abuse. So they funded that. I don't know. We're applying for a small business grant to do a part one, and we're going to try to go through NIMH because they recently said that they wanted to focus on community approaches to HIV education with teachers and other people in underserved populations. So it was a good match. So we're hoping. I mean, the application day is January 7th. So hopefully. So it's not as easy, though. It's like, okay, this is a good, logical next step. You know, we have proved that there's low knowledge and high risk, and we have this to kind of show that we can do the technological piece. But providing HIV education across the country is really hard because there's different standards. I don't know if it's time for that. Standards. Right, so like national standards for HIV education. Some do not let you talk about condoms, you know, but we want to have a curriculum to meet all the different states. I am trying to get my CD out.
Okay.
My CD is stuck in the computer. I don't know how to get it. Normally there's like a little button. Oh, maybe it's this?
Let's try this first. Okay, where's the... I think we have to shut this down first.
Oh. That was very good to meet you, and I will hopefully see you tomorrow. Thank you for introducing me. There's a button over here, but they see normally there's like a little tiny button, right?
Yeah.
I don't know what this button is, but hopefully I didn't just screw up.
Oh,
I didn't even see that. Thank you so much. This was really a great day. I don't know what you just saw. Is it that little button? Thank you. And good luck with
your... pastor, I'm doing the book. Because I refuse to do one of the most generous. Carrie Fire, I feel guilty if I throw it away.
I know. It's
so
true.
I use it. And it has to be done way ahead. I've got 8x11. Basically,
yeah.
And
what I'll
do is possibly
look perfectly
good. Sometimes
I'll get in the garage. Yeah, that's okay. We used to do that all the time. I mean, we did it this year. It's a novelty, but.
Well, my boss will. So it's the scientific affairs of the garage. Well, he does it because of her. Scientific affairs. You know, like I'm back in the dark age.
Isn't that amazing?
It's really easy to put too much text in to do it.
Right.
Difficult.
Right. It is. It's hard to even navigate which direction your eye is supposed to go in. Oftentimes you end up reading this way, but it was supposed to go that. Yeah.
And there's some people that don't really have large typefaces graphically most of them.
Yeah, it's a hard time. No, I agree. I like the PowerPoint wise being.
Yeah.